Ready to connect with the investment community here in Cleveland? Want to learn about the people, events, projects, and firms that are making a difference? Want all that but feel like you don't have the time? This is the show for you. Welcome to Guardians of Finance. Brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland and hosted by Matt McLaughlin, portfolio specialist at Diamond Hill Capital Management, Guardians of Finance will provide you with a chance to foster deeper connections and know what is getting the attention of Cleveland's investment community. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head to guardiansoffinance.com where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland and attend an educational or social event and find volunteer opportunities. And now, here's your host, Matt McLaughlin.
Welcome to the Guardians of Finance podcast. I am your host, Matt McLaughlin. In this episode, we talk with Russell Medick, Executive Chairman and Investment Analyst at North Beach Holdings, LLC. Russell is a lifelong Clevelander, a Buffett Munger disciple, and an extreme sports enthusiast. We dive into all of those interests and more in this conversation that starts with the lawn care business and ends with mentions of the 1995 Cleveland Grand Prix. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode with Russell Medick. Russell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Matt. Happy to be here and very grateful for the opportunity.
Absolutely. So maybe just tell us a little about yourself, just maybe a quick overview of your background and what you're doing right now.
Sure thing. Born, raised, educated, all in Cleveland, Ohio. Lifelong investor, started in the public markets, 1996, right out of college. And currently working, spending all my time and energy on North Beach Holdings, which is an investment holding company that owns both public and private companies all under one roof. Not a hedge fund, it's not a private equity fund, it's an amalgamation of both. The common strategy that goes through both those things is these are service companies with a lot of recurring revenue, high switching costs, and are generally acyclical. Doesn't matter what's going on with the economy, these things should do okay in recessions and expansions, all that stuff.
North Beach, is that a specific place that you like, or is that an actual location, or what's the significance of that?
I get that all the time. Now, it's an imaginary location, a beach. I'm a surfer, or used to do it a lot more than I do now, but it's a mythical location where everything is absolutely perfect. The wave is perfect, the wind's perfect, the beach is perfect. Some people have said, is North Beach in Cleveland because it's the North Coast? No. But yeah, it's a mythical location where everything is perfect.
Surfing. How did you get into surfing? It sounds like you've been born, raised, and stayed in Cleveland, Ohio. What was the genesis of that?
So I started punk rocker skateboarder as a teenager, and skateboarding led me to snowboarding, which led me to surfing. And when I was a punk kid, my friends and I used to drive from Cleveland out to the East Coast to go surfing when hurricanes were pushing into the East Coast, which, you know anything about surfing, that's not the best time to be out there. We didn't know anything, but we would go out there and have fun. And yes, I have surfed in Lake Erie in the winter. There's a whole bunch of really cool dudes that do that on a regular basis when the wind is just right and hits a break at Edgewater just right. I've not done that in many years because I'm getting too old and it's too cold for me, but nonetheless, it's a lot of fun.
It sounds like, given the brief overview of your investment philosophy with your surfing philosophy, are very different. One is very risk-taking and one is very risk-averse from the sounds of it. Is that your outlet? I'll go take the risk over there because my day life, I'm trying to avoid risk.
You got it. Yes. I don't know. For some reason, I've been very attracted to the extreme sports. I'm also a mountain biker. And a lot of times I find myself at 50 years old, probably going way too fast. But I've caught some shoulders on trees here and there, but it is a nice outlet. Those type of activities really focus your mind at the time. You cannot think about anything else other than hitting your line on a mountain bike or riding your wave or doing the right trick in skateboarding. And I love that. It just really cuts the chatter out, which is good.
I mean, I feel like we all have to have that, whether it's a competitive or risk or whatever outlet, given we're in finance and oftentimes the job is intense and maybe people from the outside will think it's boring. I think it's interesting, but we got to have that little outlet. So can definitely appreciate that. Just rewind a little bit and go back to your early childhood and your adolescent, maybe up to your college years. Just tell us about yourself, where you're born and raised around Cleveland, and take us through your collegiate years.
Born on the south side in Brunswick, Fireside Drive, in a relatively unprivileged upbringing. On Fireside Drive, as a kid, you work. You're put to work pretty early. I cut lawns. I worked in restaurants. I moved drywall for an uncle who was a contractor. became very obsessed with working and being able to fund my lifestyle as a kid, so to speak. Went to St. Ignatius High School, downtown Cleveland. That took me through to John Carroll University. And then I also have an MBA from Case Western Reserve. The pivotal moment for me as a kid was, again, I mentioned cutting lawns. And I was cutting the lawns for the largest lawn on our street. And I got paid $20 for the lawn, which was absolutely incredible at the time. I couldn't believe I landed this job. And normally, every week I would deal with the wife who would pay me $20. One day she was gone and I went to the door after I was done and the husband opened the door and invited me in to try to find a $20 bill laying around. And I got to talking to him about what he was doing. I don't remember how the conversation went. I think he probably led it. But what I figured out is he had the biggest house and lawn on the street. He's in here doing something with stocks. What I figured out was he was making decisions with his brain, why I'm out there on his lawn, busting my ass, you know, trying to earn $20. He's in here in the air conditioning, trying to make money for himself. And I'm like, I didn't know what that meant, but I swore that I have to figure out what this is and figure out how to do it. And that really got me going in that direction. And then one thing led to another. And today, here I am.
Did that propel you to be a finance major in college or know that's the way you wanted to take your career path?
Yes, though I was not a finance major in college. I had two majors, economics and chemistry. When I went to John Carroll, I had a bunch of credits coming in. I had the capacity to do two majors. I couldn't do a complete finance major and something else, but I could do economics through the School of Art and Science and a chemistry degree. I'm like, oh, why not do that if I can? So well-rounded science and business. So that's what I ended up doing.
Why chemistry? What was the interest there?
Who knows? It sounded interesting at the time. By the end, I had no idea what was going on. I have no clue to this day how I passed a lot of the chemistry classes. It's unclear to me. And I have nightmares, repeated nightmares about being in biochemistry class and not knowing anything that's going on, just being completely lost. It's horrifying.
Have you ever used any aspect of that? I know you went the finance route, which we'll get into, but did chemistry pop up at all along the way? Or is it just kind of like, I'm out of college, I'm done with that?
Basically, post-traumatic stress syndrome. That said, my son, who is 25, will be 26 shortly. He's working on his PhD in genetics at the University of Michigan. And I don't know, maybe it's helped me through his educational career sometime here and there. But at this point, the shit he's working on way over my head and no idea what's going on. But nonetheless,
maybe he uses a buzzword that you can actually understand that most people wouldn't understand.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you get done at John Carroll. Did you go right into your MBA or did you maybe take a job right out of college? Take us through your early professional life.
At John Carroll, I had a wonderful stats professor, Dr. Andrew Welke. He was not an investor, but he was very well networked for an academic, especially at John Carroll. Knew a lot of people in the Cleveland business community. And he knew I was very interested in the stock market and investing. So he pointed me in a direction of a lot of different people that I started talking to. One of them was a gentleman by the name of Marty Burke, who was an Ignatius and John Carroll grad, was running a firm called Van Cleef Asset Management. And I fell in love with what they were doing. And I started working there in August of 1996 as a grunt. I did all kinds of administration. I became the trader, became an analyst, and then a portfolio manager, and eventually left as a part owner of that firm in 2008. But Marty Burke still is an incredible human being. My father taught me how to be a man, but Marty Burke taught me how to be a businessman. I learned a lot from him about investing, about just how to be a business person in the community. So he's just a wonderful human being. Gave me an incredible opportunity to learn how to be an analyst and an investor as well. I'm totally grateful for that opportunity with him. He's now retired and really great guy, but I'm still friends with a lot of the people at Van Cleef that I worked with back in the day. So wonderful firm.
What was the catalyst for then going back and getting your MBA, I'm guessing in your early professional career?
Back then, you do a CFA or an MBA. They were thought at the time to be equivalent. I think now, that's not the case. I think the CFA is a much preferred designation than the MBA. I'm lazy by nature. The MBA just seemed easier than the CFA. I'm not the smartest knife in the drawer, so to speak. I ended up doing the MBA. Learned a lot. Great experience. Went part-time in the evenings at Case. Wonderful program, wonderful professors, wonderful classmates. Really great experience. Learned a lot.
You worked for Van Cleef for a while. You mentioned you left as a partner. Take us through your progression through that organization. You rose up and sounds like a pretty successful stint there. What was that progression like?
Again, that started off as a grunt, left as a partner. I was an analyst at heart. I'm not a client person. And I wanted to take my bag of tricks on the road. So I was going to go work for a startup hedge fund in New York City that was going to allow me to commute back and forth. I was not real excited about moving to New York. Love New York. I'm just not excited about moving there. That was in 2008. We were going to start up January 1st, 2009. Long story short, the fund never started up and I was out of a job. I ended up pivoting, doing an array of different things in both public and private markets starting in 2008, which was a lot of fun. New experiences on the private side, was on some boards, helped a lot of entrepreneurs grow some local companies here and there. Also doing some public company analyst work, outsourced CIO and analyst work for some firms around Cleveland and Columbus. And then landed a gig at Sequoia Financial Group down in Akron as the chief investment officer in 2013. Helped that firm grow from $1 billion of assets under management when I left in 2019, 2020, about $10 billion of assets under management. Heck of a ride in terms of growth. Wonderful firm, wonderful people. I think now they're probably north of $20 billion. I left because I always had this corny dream of building my own little mini Berkshire Hathaway. I'm a longtime Berkshire Hathaway shareholder. I've been going to Omaha for many years. And frankly, I wanted to public companies and private companies all under one roof. And similar to what Warren Buffett has done, and that's what North Beach has turned out to be. So that's what I'm working on.
When you left Van Cleef and were going for that startup hedge fund, and then it didn't work out, was that pretty disappointing? Or was that something that was like, oh, I'm glad that didn't work out because I didn't have to move to New York and whatnot? Tell us what that was like.
I still have mixed feelings about that. One is, if we did start up, I think our track record starting up close to the bottom would have been incredible, but it would not have allowed me to do all the cool stuff I've done since then locally here in Cleveland. Again, mixed bag, but I have no regrets and happy it turned out the way it did. So,
was that the main opportunity that you had to leave Cleveland? And what has kept you here all those years?
That was the one time I tried to leave. And again, I wasn't going to move to New York, but I'd spent a lot of time there. I love Cleveland. My family's here. My wife's family's here. I love the people. I love the culture. I mentioned all the outdoor stuff I like to do. You can do it all here in Cleveland, which is absolutely incredible. I love to eat. The food scene actually punches well above its weight here in Cleveland, which I like a lot. And say nothing about the cost of living. It's incredible what you can buy for a dollar here compared to other places in the country. So looking at this winter, seems like the winters are improving. Who knows?
I agree. It's not been too bad. The spring's been a little iffy so far, at least in March. We're recording this in March, but I'm sure it'll get nicer here soon. You mentioned you've been to Omaha, sounds like almost every year for a while as a shareholder. For anyone who hasn't gone to Omaha for the Berkshire meeting, what's it like?
It is absolutely incredible. There is no place in the world I'd want to be on the first Saturday in May than Omaha, Nebraska. It's not unlike going to church, totally surrounded by like-minded folks. And the activities are led by two of the, now one, of the greatest investors of all time, the GOATs, so to speak. And it's just absolutely wonderful. And the Kentucky Derby is generally also the same day, the first Saturday in May. That's always a lot of fun to go to a bar with a bunch of people and you watch the horses run, which is cool. So it's absolutely incredible. Omaha is a wonderful city. Again, another great food scene, punches a bit above its weight as well. But then when you're surrounded by like-minded folks, it is just a giant party. I get there a couple of days early, stay a couple of days later, and have an awesome time. So it's absolutely wonderful.
Are you sure that's not the reason you didn't do the CFA? Because you knew you'd have to be studying at that time for at least back when the tests were in June and you couldn't go to Omaha. Or maybe you could go to Omaha, but
again, I'm lazy. I like to have fun. So
having gone through the CFA program, those May weekends are just in my mind, just okay, nothing's happening. Kentucky Derby, not going to happen. Indianapolis 500, can't have fun there. And after the CFA program, I got over, I think it was just a sense of relief that I could actually participate in those May activities, but I digress. Starting North Beach. So you're at Sequoia for a while. What was the catalyst for starting North Beach and take us through your thought process there?
I've always had, again, this corny dream of starting my own little mini Berkshire Hathaway. I had taken a small position, minority position in a private company here in Cleveland in 2009 called ACN Solutions. And ACN is a company that helps financial service firms make required legal filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Wonderful company. It checks all the boxes in terms of our investment process, recurring revenue. It's an essential service, very small. cost to our customers compared to their overall cost base, but it's an incredibly important service that we provide. So our customers are hedge funds and investment companies, and we help them make these filings with the SEC on their EDGAR system, which is a notoriously difficult computer platform to deal with. We make it very easy, and we can do this stuff much cheaper than they can do it in-house, especially doing it from Cleveland, Ohio, versus New York City or Chicago or Hong Kong or London or wherever they are. We do more filings than anybody in the world, which is cool. I bought that portion of that company in 2009. I had the opportunity to buy the rest of it in 2017 from the founder and did just that. And that is really the catalyst that started North Beach in its existence today. Recruited a former intern of mine at Sequoia, Dylan Thompson, to help me run ACN day to day. And I told him that let's go buy a bunch of other private companies and do this public-private thing all under one roof. And we bought our second company in 2020. It's a non-emergency medical transportation company out in Fremont, Ohio, and then bought two more companies in early 2021 as well. Since then, we've looked at a lot of companies, thousands of them over the years, and we're in the midst of purchasing an additional one as we speak. And we're going to continue to look for more. For us, the flywheel is let's take the free cash flow that these private companies are spinning off and let's compound that over a long period of time by buying more private companies and more public companies, which has been our game plan and process.
How do you manage that mix between public and private?
For us, there's no fundamental difference between a public or private company. We treat the underwriting, the ownership the same. It's long-term ownership. And today, we can find better value in private companies than we can in public companies. And so we've focused more on the private companies. That may change in the future. Who knows? So that's basically just the relative valuation opportunities that we're seeing in the market, both in private and public. And I should say that, again, I'm not the smartest knife in the drawer. I try to go where I don't have any competition. So we buy pretty small private companies, less than $5 million of EBITDA, and relatively small public companies, microcap, nanocap companies as well. Again, a lot less competition there, which is good.
Why do you think you've been able to, or at least right now, are finding better valuations in private companies? Is it the liquidity premium, or is there something else there that you see?
I think there's a huge supply side shock of companies for sale. A lot of baby boomers own these small companies, small private companies. Things like, I don't know, $15 trillion of value need to be transferred over the next 10 or 15 years. It's a lot of value that needs to change hands. I think there's the supply side shock. And then on the demand side, companies less than $5 million of EBITDA, those are way too small for most private equity shops. It doesn't really move the needle so much. If you don't have somebody in-house that could buy the company, there's not a lot of competition, again, to buy those. And so as a result, the valuations of those small private companies stay relatively reasonable, which is very helpful for us.
How do you source those private companies? It seems like these are really diamonds in the rough, and I don't want you to give away your secret sauce on here if you don't want to, but it seems like a very niche area of the market. Just wondering how you source those. Is it a network? Is it investment bankers? How do you come about those?
Every which way possible. That is the most difficult part of private company investing. It's trying to find the companies that fit the investment checklist. And we're looking for some really weirdo type of stuff, real niche type of stuff out there. So it's every which way possible. We network with accountants, attorneys, wealth managers. We've built databases of small companies that check the boxes. The PPP loan database that was released had been an absolute gold mine for us. As I mentioned, Dylan Thompson was able to put together my partner, a database of these companies that could fit a lot of information about them that you can back into, make sure they fit the bill. That's been very helpful. And we bang away on every which way possible to try to find good companies for us to buy. We've looked at probably well over 1,000 of them, and we've bought 4, going on 5. The funnel is very small at the bottom there.
Now, do you guys have funds that you've launched, or maybe just one fund? How is the pooling of assets go about at North Beach?
So this is an investment holding company, and I own, call it, close to 70% of North Beach. And then I have a handful of outside owner partners, actually in some inside owner partners as well. Dylan Thompson, as an example. It's one company that owns everything, the private companies and the public companies. There's no fund. There's no capital calls or commitments. We have this pile of capital, permanent capital that we're working on growing. I don't take a salary. We don't take fees. The only way that our team gets compensated is by taking a slice of anything good that happens to North Beach. Dollar free cash flow is generated or unrealized gain, and public side will take a slice of that to live off of.
Are you and maybe others at North Beach, are you guys more Buffett people? Are you more Munger people? From an investment perspective, are you quality? Are you more Ben Graham value? Where do you guys lie in that spectrum?
I started off as a growth investor. I didn't find Buffett until 2001. I've been a lifelong Buffett deep value guy. Now I've been slowly coming around to the Munger approach with high quality at a reasonable price. But I still have the Buffett in me, so to speak. I just get so excited with negative enterprise value companies or something like that, tons of cash on the balance sheet approach. But nonetheless, we want to grow over time. And so that sort of speaks to more Munger these days.
So you went from one side, the growth side, to a deep value side. How did you reconcile that when you're like, oh, I want a growth company? I know they're not opposites or shouldn't be opposites, but how did you reconcile that when you were shifting that philosophy?
It was very painful. I'll tell you, I started in 1996, right? And that was the lead up to the dot-com bubble. And when I started, I'm like, this is the greatest business in the world. I can just buy these tech companies and make a ton of money. And that worked really well to 2000, 2001. And then I learned the other side of this. I'm like, oh man, that hurt. And so I figured out, okay, that was not so good. How do I avoid that pain in the future? And so I said, I got to study who figured this out before me. It's very easy. You know, Warren Buffett was a perfect example of that. And I'm like, well, I got to figure out what this guy is doing because he's been very successful and avoided all this pain. So that's when I fell in love with Buffett. So I was somewhat of a late lover to Buffett, but here I am today. So found religion.
Do you ever, given NVIDIA and the Mag 7 right now, do you ever regret that? Like, oh man, maybe I should dabble in the growth companies again.
No, because I feel like it'll end badly, but who knows. But 2013, you could buy Microsoft, NVIDIA very cheaply. I think NVIDIA was selling at $15, $7 of cash on the balance sheet. It was a really cheap stock back in 2013. Microsoft, 2013, you can get the whole Windows franchise and part of the Office complex for free. Those were great times to buy. Those companies were value at 2013, owned them. And of course, held them for a few years and then sold them. But biggest mistake is should have held them because could have made a lot more money.
Sure. And you don't have to comment on any specific stocks, but it seems like valuations right now are getting less and less attractive. Are you guys seeing that? Or given maybe you play in the micro, smaller cap area and private area, maybe you're not seeing that multiple or that discount intrinsic value close?
Where we play these micro and nano cap stuff seems like a reasonable valuation. And you can find some really interesting companies at good prices today. And that's where we're looking. Listen, I would love to own Microsoft. It's an incredible service company at the end of the day. Checks all of our boxes. However, I can't stomach the valuation. So it's forcing me into these smaller companies where we can find better valuation.
Turning to a personal side, you mentioned some of your interest in mountain biking and surfing and whatnot. What else on the personal side are your passions? You mentioned a son, so family and whatnot there. What on the personal side drives you other than the extreme sports?
Reading. Love to read. I've got a daily goal of 50 pages of nonfiction. Always start my day out reading. Addicted to that. Music always has been a huge part of my life. Mostly listening to music. I'm not much of a player, though you can probably find me in my office with music turned up loud, pretending to play the guitar, but not really knowing what I'm doing. Love music. Big fisherman. Grew up fishing with my father on Lake Erie. Some of the bass lakes around town here. So anytime I can go fishing, I'm down to do that. And as I mentioned, I love to eat. Growing up in an Italian household, my mother being Italian, we were forced to eat all the time. And now I've had appreciation for fantastic food.
That's a good segue into our rapid fire lightning round, if you will. We can go through some more lighthearted questions that maybe some of the points you showed in there we'll expand on a little bit. You ready for that?
Sure thing. Bring it on.
Do you have a nickname?
I have a nickname that I don't particularly like. It's Rusty. So I'm a junior. My father is also named Russell. So my mom would always call me Rusty. And for some reason, people will catch on over the years and will start calling me Rusty. Like my wife's brothers and my brother-in-laws will call me Rusty all the time to tease me. But yeah, that's probably the one nickname that has stuck over the years.
That you're hoping more people, it doesn't stick to them. Where were you when don't know if this is the right way to use the term, but have you found your North Beach? Where is that one perfect wave on that perfect beach? What's the top surfing memory for you?
That's a great question. I've had many. There was a great wave I caught in Maine, believe it or not. Water was very cold, but that was a lot of fun. Outer Banks, there's a number of great waves up and down the Outer Banks, which has been really good. I've only surfed the West Coast one time, and the conditions were horrible. Done a little bit of surfing in Florida, but really it's been Outer Banks has been my go-to place.
Favorite book about investing finance? Is it The Intelligent Investor?
That is a good one. My favorite has to be probably Poor Charlie's Almanac, the collective speeches and writing of Charlie Munger put together by Peter Kaufman. That collection of work has been so helpful in terms of how to be rational in both life and investing, and it's really shaped my approach in both life and investing, which has been really good. I think that's probably my favorite book. I read a lot of biographies and autobiographies about investors, and I've gotten a lot more from those type of books than I have somebody talking about their investment process. Really like those.
Who's maybe one of the most interesting biographies that maybe the average person wouldn't realize that you're like, wow, that person's super interesting and a lot of people don't know about this person?
Bruce Halley, the founder of Discount Tire. There's a book, a biography about him called Six Tires, No Plan, how he built Discount Tire from one little shop in Ann Arbor, Michigan to a national chain. It is absolutely incredible to think about how he's built that company, the process that he used. And again, it's all applicable to an investment process, which has been really helpful. I think that's an incredible one. And any entrepreneur or investor really should seek out that book. It's really cool.
That's a good recommendation. Profession you'd be in if you weren't an investor?
10 years ago, I'd probably say professional snowboarder. My body's more broken today than it used to be. Probably professional fisherman, because it's like golf. You can fish into old age. I think I'd be a professional fisherman and think that'd be a lot of fun.
Since you mentioned it, favorite spot to snowboard and favorite spot to fish?
Snowboard is probably Whistler, British Columbia. Unbelievable. Two mountains out there and had wonderful legendary trips, which has been fun. And favorite place to fish? We have a cottage in a couple hours north of Toronto in the Muskoka area. It's on a very small lake, but I love to fish that lake.
Top bucket list travel destination?
I've yet to do South America. So probably something down there, which probably a combination of like Buenos Aires and then something in the mountains, I think would be really cool.
Any hidden talents? I guess you've already mentioned quite a few talents, but any other ones that are off the wall a little bit?
Off the wall. I went to race car driving school for a weekend at Mid-Ohio, and I think I'm a very below average race car driver, but in terms of the average person, I'm probably above average. So I think it's a bit of a hidden talent. A lot of fun.
Maybe given the Italian family history, favorite recipe to cook?
I'm horrible in the kitchen. Man, it's a big regret. I wish I would have paid more attention to what my mother was doing. One of the jobs I had as a kid is I worked at Bob's Big Boy as a short order cook, and I could flip eggs and make omelets like you couldn't believe. So that was as good as I get.
The simple stuff. That's good.
Yes, exactly.
What's your favorite lunch spot in Cleveland?
I'll give you two. One of them's Italian. Il Venetian in the Marriott Hotel is fantastic. And I think very underrated. Not a lot of people show up there, but it's unbelievable. The eggplant rollatini there is absolute perfection. And then the Literary Tavern, I think in Tremont, is another great go-to spot. The veal meatballs there, also fantastic.
Two questions I think might go together. Your favorite metro park and favorite mountain bike track around the Cleveland area?
Oh, that's a good question. So I live in Strongsville, so Royal View is my go-to metro park. They have an incredible mountain bike trail there. Actually, there are tons of great Cleveland mountain bike trails around here. They're maintained by mountain bikers. They're very technical, which is a lot of fun. So I've mountain biked out in West Coast and Utah and Colorado. We're very lucky to have these type of mountain biking assets here in town. So Royal View has been my go-to metro park. And my favorite mountain bike spot is probably Vulture's Knob, which again, I'm getting too old for that place because it's very technical and very steep, but it's a lot of fun though.
What book are you reading now?
This is going to sound crazy, but it's a book about owls and what makes owls awesome. I live in the woods a bit and there are tons of owls around us. And so I wanted to learn about how they hunt, how they communicate, stuff like that. So that's what I'm reading about.
What's your most memorable Cleveland sports moment?
I'm embarrassed to say that I'm not a very good Cleveland sports fan. I have to bug my son all the time for the talking points. But for me, there were two actually events that happened in Cleveland, if sports events, if that can count. The 1995 Cleveland Grand Prix, they used to run this Indy class car race in Cleveland at Burke Lakefront Airport. One of the jobs I had in college, I worked at Jones Day, the law firm, as a grunt. But they had this awesome balcony or deck on the backside of the building that overlooked Burke Lakefront. You can watch the race from there. But the 1995 race was absolutely fantastic. It was won by a guy named Jacques Villeneuve, who actually went on to win in 1997 or so, the F1 championship. So it was a real privilege to see him run the Cleveland track. And it was just a thing of beauty. And there was a lot of overtakes in the last few laps, which just made it absolutely thrilling. That was cool. And then moment in skateboarding history, the 2007, I think Mountain Dew Extreme Games came through Cleveland. It's at that North Coast Harbor area. It was so awesome to see these amazing professional skateboarders in Cleveland, Bucky Lasek, Bob Burnquist, Sean White, the great Olympic snowboarder. Seeing them in vert ramps in Cleveland was really cool and very memorable for me.
I'm a Cleveland sports fan, but we have never had those two examples. I love the difference in how you answer that, because, you know, it's the Cavs and the Browns and whatnot, and everyone has those moments, but I love those two examples. Russell, thanks a lot for being on the podcast. You're off the hot seat, and we appreciate you coming on and having the conversation.
Thank you very much. Again, I love what you're doing. I think it's an absolute asset for the Cleveland investment community, what you're doing with the CFA Society. So thank you again. Again, honored to be a part of this.
Thanks. Appreciate the kind words.
You've been listening to Guardians of Finance, brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head on over to guardiansoffinance.com, where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland, attend an educational or social event, and find volunteer opportunities. Thanks, and we'll see you next time on Guardians of Finance.